Hey, please support.
Give us just a second here, Mr. Stover. Get your...
All set, Your Honor.
Settled, and then we can start. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. The 493 patent in suit is Syntex's third patent in a series to unlawfully extend its patent monopoly. Its first patent covered KT, heteroelectromethamine, the active ingredient. Its second patent, the Waterbury patent, covered KT in an ophthalmic formulation. The third patent before us is an alleged improvement patent, but is invalid for obviousness. This court stated in its 2005 opinion that the district court had committed at least five clear errors, one being that the unvarnished view of the prosecution history shows some weakness in the conclusion that the patentee established unexpected results for the claims surfactant. Despite these clear five errors, the district court did not change a single ruling.
But you went back to the district court and the roadmap that at least was established by the last opinion of this court was not followed?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Is that what
you're saying? Yes, Your Honor.
Is there additional evidence that was submitted?
No, Your Honor, it was merely attorney argument at that
point. So it's really attorney argument plus reweighing of the evidence?
Correct, Your Honor.
You're asking us to reweigh it again?
Unfortunately, yes, we're back here for now the fifth time. In addition to the remand, this court has vacated three interlocutory, we had to come here three times to have vacated the judge's TRO and preliminary injunction, so that we're now back here for the fifth time.
I think the court's pretty familiar with the procedure in this case. Obviously, it's been around a few years,
right.
And a few opinions have been issued regarding the appeal orders. But what I'm still concerned about, do you want us to reweigh the evidence on behalf of the lower court? The same evidence that was there before, you want us to reweigh it? I mean, that's not our function.
No, what I believe the court should do is find the clear errors that the district court made yet again. They were pointed out to the district court in this court's last opinion, and despite the roadmap that the court gave them, the court still chose to make clear errors in its finding, and I'd like to go through those to point out the continued clear error that the district court made when it was asked to reweigh and relook at the evidence in light of this court's directions. I'd also like to point out to the court an opinion that issued 2 weeks ago, the Pfizer versus Apotex case, March 22, 2007, appeal 2006-1261. Where the court held that claims covering a specific pharmaceutically acceptable salt were obvious over the prior art and there were no unexpected results. As we know, the 493 patent inventor Ligate submitted her declaration to the PTO attempting to find and show unexpected results. But for that declaration, the 493 patent would not have issued. This court found as a fact that the pharmaceutical expert report 303 established an important fact that octoxynol 40 was a well-known ingredient in pharmaceutical products at the time of the invention. The district court clearly erred when it mischaracterized the court's remand order and incorrectly found that octoxynol 40 may have been used in one or more unknown pharmaceutical products and gave it only limited weight. Now, when we look at the Ligate declaration for unexpected results, there are four important factors: what it included, what it omitted, and when and how she tested the octoxynols.
Was there anything in the record other than one passing statement in a report that 040 was well known in the art?
Actually, Syntex cited...
And that was, of course, with reference to cosmetics, more than pharmaceuticals.
Well, actually, 303 did not... It said pharmaceuticals. It did not say cosmetics.
And then the expert witnesses, when your expert witness, when asked, said, well, no, he doesn't know of anything, except maybe cosmetics.
Correct. But there were three...
That's your witness.
That's my witness. He said that it had been well known for use as a surfactant and had been used in cosmetics.
Not in pharmaceuticals.
Not to his knowledge, but if you look at the file...
That's your witness.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, if we're reweighing the evidence, you just lost, didn't you?
No, Your Honor, because when you look at the file history, there were three pieces of prior art that showed octoxynol 40 was well known in the art. When we looked at the 493 patent and the unexpected results, it showed that the solutions were to remain clear over time. That's shown in column 8 of the patent. When Lydgate tested the 12.5 and the octoxanol 40, she found they looked equivalent, a visual comparison. She made no other finding. The day she tested the octoxanol 3, the 12.5, and the 040, she didn't even prepare the octoxanol 5. She did that three months later. She only did that when she discovered that 12.5 and 040 looked equivalent. So she knew she had two out of the three looked equivalent. So she immediately prepared the octoxanol 5. She knew when she prepared those solutions that they would fail. She knew octoxanol 3 and octoxanol 5 were not soluble in water. They were turbid when she took them out of the bottle. She expected that they would fail in the test that she submitted. Therefore, she didn't even have to put them on stability. There was nothing unexpected about that result. She testified, as Dr. Mitra testified, that they're water insoluble and that they are turbid. And there's no unexpected results. Dr. Mitra testified that no one in their right mind would compare two water insoluble surfactants to a water soluble surfactant, namely octoxanol 40. Dr. Freiberg, who prosecuted the 493 patent, also knew that octoxanol 3 and octoxanol 5 were water insoluble. The literature showed...
Because they were oil-based?
They were oil-based, and as Dr. Mitra testified, their ethylene oxide chains were too short to be able to form micelles. And as Dr. Stella even testified, that you know you have to be able to form micelles and have to be above the CMC, critical micelle concentration level, in order to solubilize a KT-BAC interaction. No one has ever explained to this day why the octoxanol 3 data is in that Lydgate declaration. Dr. Freiberg said he left out the 12.5 data because it wasn't in the prior art and it wasn't part of the claim of invention. Well, neither was octoxanol 3. There was no justification for putting in two water-insoluble surfactants when comparing it to the water-soluble. We submit, had the 12.5 data been included in the Lydgate declaration, it would not have shown unexpected results.
You're asking us to reweigh the evidence. Let me switch our focus a little bit. You challenge the permanent injunction here. Given that Hatch-Waxman's an artificial infringement case in the first place, and the statute says that upon a ruling against you, there shall be nothing that issues, why isn't that tantamount to a permanent injunction?
Because we submit that the court still must go through the factual analysis, and we came back
here. You lose. There's a patent in place. The Hatch-Waxman Act has given you a free shot without infringing at proving your case, and you failed. And the statute says now, since you failed, FDA will not issue any certification for you to proceed to market. And yet you say, no, we should still be allowed to proceed to market?
No, I'm saying that the court should have at least made the analysis that would have allowed us...
No, we're working a legal argument here, not a procedural one. I'm wondering, on the law, where is your argument that there needs to be any analysis, given that the context of a Hatch-Waxman?
Well, Your Honor, neither side has cited any case specifically on point.
No, of course, there's nothing yet. This is his first time.
So,
I look at the language of the statute. It says the court shall order. I mean, the eBay analysis in an injunction is predicated on some modicum of discretion by the trial court. And just as Judge Rader mentioned, where's the discretion in 271E4A, which says the court shall? Where's the discretion there?
Well, our point, Your Honor, is that the court should engage in the analysis so that if one of the four factors is an overriding factor, for example, a public interest factor, it could still find that an injunction due to public interest would not be...
So in other words, a generic would always get to on the market as long as it was an important health-saving drug, right? Because they would argue public interest, we can't, it's an infringement, but... We're allowed to go on the marketplace because this is an important for public safety.
not in every instance, if it were an extreme emergency or something.
But in any instance, where is the discretion, as Judge Prost was pointing out to you, to even reach that point?
Well, Your Honor, we submit that the district court still must engage in
analysis. Just because you're an important drug, you can ignore the rights of the party that developed that drug at a cost of billions of dollars. Is that what you're saying? I invent the cure for AIDS. Because I've invented the cure for AIDS, you get to put it on the marketplace as a generic, undercutting my billions of dollars of investment just because it's a cure for AIDS. Is that your argument?
No, Your Honor, but if the court had...
No, tell me why that isn't your argument.
Your Honor, what we're saying is that the court must have engaged in the analysis, because if...
That's procedural. We're talking the law, you and I here. Help me with the law. Why isn't that your legal argument? That's what you want, right?
Yes, Your Honor, if there's an override...
Thank you. At least we got to that point. But where in the statute are you given any right to make that argument?
The statute does say shall, so it does not explicitly...
Give you the right to make that argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you want the right to go back and argue over the permanent injunction, but assuming hypothetically you were to affirm the district court on the findings with respect to obviousness, it would leave the 271 order in place. So why does it matter whether you get the injunction if you're still left with not being able to get FDA approval in any way?
That is certainly a practical aspect of it, Your Honor.
But you couldn't produce without the FDA approval.
No, because in this particular case, there was only tentative approval. There was not any final approval issued by the time of the litigation decision.
It was subject to the certification.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if you don't have the approval, then you can't produce with or without the injunction.
Correct.
So why would you need the injunction?
It was more a matter of showing the district court's failure to properly analyze, as it had done in so many instances in this case. This court has vacated its prior opinions on injunctions no less than 3 times. And here, it didn't engage in a single analytical point on the injunction at all. But
that was still dependent upon the outcome of the obviousness analysis on the remand.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the injunction at that point was probably premature, wasn't it? On the part of the court to not have had any kind of an analysis at that point. I think the rationale for the court to dissolve those injunctions was based upon the inability to determine how and why it was issued. Because there was no rationale behind it.
Yeah.
So why is it now there's a rationale, basically a finding of validity? At least as far as the statute is concerned, you couldn't produce without FDA approval with or without the injunction, period.
That is
correct. I don't even know why they need the injunction.
That is correct. As Ms. Lydgate testified at trial, going back to the unexpected results, she testified that as shown in column 4 of the patent, any of the many surfactants listed in column 4 of the patent would have been useful in her alleged invention. In addition, the file history showed that any non-ionic surfactant in an ophthalmic and in a stabilizing amount was within the scope of the invention. That's Exhibit 24, JA 10, 45, 46. These are clear admissions that virtually any water-soluble, non-ionic surfactant is suitable in the claimed invention. District Court clearly erred when it held there were no test results at the time of the invention that showed that other surfactants would work equally well compared to octoxinol 40.
You're into your rebuttal. Do you want to hang on?
I'll stop right now, Your Honor.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mr. Silver, and we'll hear from Mr. Brayman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court. It goes without saying that Apotex has a very heavy burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the 493 patent is obvious. They've had 2 bites at the apple, a 3-week trial, and an extensive remand hearing before Judge Jenkins. And they haven't come close either time. And I think that the thrust of their arguments and their reasons, to some extent here today, is to try to deflect our attention away from that fact by taking a tax at Judge Jenkins.
But Mr. Brainerd, when the remand order was issued and the matter went back and the reweighing of the evidence took place, it seems that they came up with the same results as before without too much reweighing of the evidence.
Well, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think if one were to look at the extensive findings of fact and conclusions of law that Judge Jenkins went through, he carefully reviewed all of the evidence pursuant to your instructions. I'm happy to review any of that with you. For example, he went back and looked through each piece of prior art, specifically having in mind and reciting the fact that you had instructed him that he should never look at those pieces of art as teaching away. And so he did that extensively. And he went through each piece of prior art, that would be the Waterbury, Hahn, and Gilbert references, along with McCutcheon, and carefully articulated what was missing from those pieces of prior art. And then, in a further discussion, gave his opinion as to, after weighing all of the evidence, why none of that art would provide a motivation to combine, and why it certainly wouldn't teach the invention of the 493 patent. So I think in that regard, he did that. And I'm happy to discuss any of that art, and explain to you why Judge Jenkins reached that conclusion and why it's the right conclusion. He was criticized for not going back and looking at the Syntex report, or whatever you want to call it, the Lydgate Fu report. He did that. He did that very carefully. Now, he weighed that evidence. That's what a trial judge is supposed to do. He's supposed to weigh the evidence. He looked at that report, and the testimony from Fu and Lydgate was, we don't recall what pharmaceutical we had in mind at the time we made that statement in that report. So the status of the record in front of Judge Jenkins, as he took a look at that report pursuant to your instructions, was, yes, octoxyl 40 may have been used in one or more pharmaceutical applications. We don't know what kind of application. We don't know what octoxyl 40 was used for, whether it was ever used in an ophthalmic application, whether it was ever used in an ophthalmic application in a safe manner, whether it was ever used to resolve the complexation or incompatibility between a carboxyl group NSAID and a quaternary ammonium preservative. He had none of that. And then he compares that to the testimony of their own witness, Dr. Mitra, who testified rather uncategorically that based upon his knowledge, and this was a man of skill in the science who presumably had gone through during this trial and looked very hard to find one, he did not know of any prior use or existing use of octoxyl 40 in any pharmaceutical other than Aculin.
Mr. Brainerd, I'm going to shift gears on you too.
Sure.
Let's go to the. Oh, excuse me. Yeah, my colleague has a question.
All right.
With respect to the lower court's determination on page 21, which is JA88 of the Joint Appendix, the lower court speaks to Dr. Mitra's critique of Syntex's relating testing relating to torpidity is also unpersuasive. Dr. Mitra's analysis, at least, there's a statement in the record showing that Dr. Mitra's analysis showed, my studies also show, however, that several surfactants, including oxynol 30, oxynol 10, 20, is greater turbidity as did oxynol 40. Basically relating all the water-soluble oxynols. Why is that not persuasive?
Well, as I think Judge Jenkins properly found, those tests were conducted in the year 2002. And therefore, as a matter of evidence, they're irrelevant to demonstrate what one would have known of ordinary skill in the art back in the time.
You didn't say they were not relevant. You said they were not persuasive.
Right, and he also found them to be not credible. That was another point he made as well. In addition to that, he found them not credible in part for that reason. He found them not credible in part because he found that they were scientifically flawed, because those tests did not look at and evaluate the variables that existed in this formulation. For example, Mitra's test only tested one batch of BAC. And there was extensive testimony in the record about BAC having different homologs, and the difference in those homologs would have a dramatic effect upon solubility. In addition to which, he had testimony from Dr. Stella, number one, that Dr. Mitra's entire scientific premise behind those tests was flawed. He had specific testimony, which is at 2080 from Dr. Stella,
Were these exactly the Stella experiments replicated?
No,
they weren't.
Really. Stella did some work, but this is Stella's testimony, looking at Meeker's analysis. Meeker's analysis was based upon a theory about how Back and Keter-Rolleck interact and how they fall out of a solution and come back in a solution. And I don't know whether the court wants me to go through the entire theory, but what Dr. Stella did is he looked at that theory or that analysis and said it's fatally flawed. The big flaw was because the more Keter-Rolleck trimethamine you put in the solution, the more Keter-Rolleck, the more K you put in, which undermined his entire analysis. So he found the analysis to be flawed for that purpose.
Fundamentally unsound.
Fundamentally unsound. Thank you, Your Honor. In addition to which, Dr. Stella at JA 2080 specifically testified that non-ionic surfactants have different chemical structures. Therefore, it performed differently, in part because they have different critical micelle concentrations. And Judge Jenkins looked at that. He also looked at the fact, which is, I think, very compelling here, that the Syntec scientists who were testing back in the 82-83 period extensively tested a wide range of surfactants and found that there was a wide diversity in how they performed, and the ultimate resolution there was that octoxyl performed better than every other one based upon extensive testing.
I'm going to shift the gears now.
Okay.
If you don't mind, Mr. Brainerd. Despite my banter with Mr. Silver, it does appear to me that there might be a reason to have an injunction even after finding that they can't go on the marketplace until the patent expires. They could, with an injunction properly denied, make a stockpile of the drugs that could be available for marketing the very instant that the patent does expire, thus speeding the generic to the marketplace. Why isn't that an appropriate reason, and why doesn't that suggest that there ought to be some consideration of injunctions post a finding of no infringement? Of infringement and validity.
Well, certainly that's a, Your Honor, has come up with a very, I suppose, for want of a better word, creative observation. And all I can say is that under the construct of the Hatch-Waxman Act, and you've already gone through this, I don't want to kind of repeat your arguments, but it's clear that Congress has set up a structure here which says if you've got a generic, it's been found to be infringing of a patent, and that patent is either is valid and not expired, the whole thrust of the Hatch-Waxman Act is to prevent you from going to market with that.
Granted.
Right.
We've already established that you don't get to go to market. The question is, do you get to further go on to the question of an injunction for the purpose of stockpiling?
Certainly it's not contemplated by the Hatch-Waxman Act. So I would say no.
Well, why isn't it? Because the Hatch-Waxman Act does leave in place the prospect of injunction.
Well, because I may be wrong on this, Your Honor, but I'm just going to throw out the only reason I can think of right now, which is, as Your Honor indicated a little while ago, there's a specific provision in the Hatch-Waxman Act that says the judge shall issue an order.
I'm not to argue that it was an artificial infringement case in the first place.
But prevents the FDA from granting approval. I don't know whether they can make anything before they get an approval. I don't know the answer. I have to confess I don't know the answer. But if in fact that's the case, that would be an adequate reason why, you know, even under an injunction, you shouldn't be allowed to start stockpiling 6 months ahead of time.
Would you need an injunction at that point, though, if they can't produce?
Well, they
can. Well, because they need FDA approval at that point?
Well, arguably the injunction under those circumstances would be sort of a belt and suspenders operation because of the clear statutory mandate of E4A, which is the statutory provision we're talking about here, clearly. Other than that, Your Honor, I can't give you any further answer to your question. I just think that when you look at this construct as a whole, which clearly says you can't go to market, you can't even get FDA approval under these circumstances, I don't think there would be any real basis coming back in front of a judge under an injunctive situation and asking permission to start stockpiling before you get approval from the FDA.
Well, wait, so are you saying that if we were to vacate because we just don't know what to do with eBay, vacate and remand to the district court judge to apply eBay, that you all would pursue your injunction in any event if indeed he otherwise left the order, the Hatch-Waxman order in place?
Well, I think we would pursue the injunction because I think the injunction is coextensive with the whole thrust of the Hatch-Waxman.
Why would you need the injunction at that point?
Well, I guess to some extent belt and suspenders, but I mean to make absolutely sure that there's no wiggle room with these folks as to whether they could go out and do something that would be contrary to the thrust of the statute.
So if you're saying you would pursue an injunction even with this order in place, then why isn't it incumbent upon us to send it back to the trial court to effectively analyze the factors under it?
Because I believe, Your Honor, that we're, as I said at the outset, and that really the primary underlying reason here is we're not operating under 283, we're operating under the Hatch-Waxman Act. And the Hatch-Waxman Act clearly creates this construct where I think we can all agree that Congress's intent was to do exactly what it said it was going to do, because Congress, in essence, saw or sensed irreparable harm if the contrary were allowed to happen.
It doesn't speak to irreparable harm.
Well, the statute doesn't speak to irreparable harm. My point, Your Honor, is when you look at the statutory construct as a whole, starting with a 30-month stay to allow this matter to be litigated in the first place, Congress is very, very intent upon preventing anything that could happen to let a generic go to market in a situation where it would be infringing a valid patent that had not yet expired.
You could also argue that the Hatch-Waxman Act had a purpose of at least increasing competition in some of these areas by allowing the generics to expedite their trip to the marketplace, except obviously under certification of Part 4.
And which, of course, man, I don't mean to be facetious, but that's where we are. So that's the ballpark.
We understand.
We
still have some time left on the patent unless we reverse the district court's decision on this. But at that point, assuming that we affirm, then the issue of whether or not an injunction would be required under the statute is questionable. But obviously, if it is still available, then maybe we should send it back and let the judge decide whether or not under eBay requirements an injunction is proper.
Well, to the extent if there's any question in the court's mind as to whether or not the judge should have issued the injunction or whether he did so properly, I would suggest it's harmless error for the reason we've already talked about. We have other issues in the brief as to whether they could have timely raised this and given Judge Jenkins the opportunity to address these issues before this matter came to the court. Our position is that they could. The opinion came out on the 15th of May. Judge Jenkins didn't even issue his order, final order in this case, and the injunction until the 2nd of June. And the final judgment in this case wasn't entered until the 18th of August. So there was ample opportunity, and I think he should have had the opportunity to confront this initially. There was ample opportunity for them to bring this matter to the attention of the judge in a motion to reconsider or some kind of a letter brief or what have you, and they made no effort to do so. So I think there's a waiver here.
Well, eBay happened in between.
eBay happened on the 50th. eBay happened after the hearing, no question about it. I think the hearing was on I haven't got that date, but it was in February. And the eBay opinion, in my recollection, came out on the 15th of May. Judge Jenkins issued the findings of fact in the order, which we have in front of us today, including the injunctive relief, on the 2nd of June. But a final judgment in this case was not entered until the 18th of August, is my point.
Has our court dealt with that? I know we've had a few opinions post-eBay where we remanded, we sent it back because of eBay. Do you know of any precedent where we've dealt with a waiver argument on the timetable, on the timing of it? I don't know.
My legal team behind me says no, so I'm going to say no, Your Honor.
That's why you have a team. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Silver, you want to comment on my attempt to pull your fat out of the fire?
No, Your Honor, I think I'll leave where it stands.
Okay.
I do want to point out that Dr. Stella, their expert, did not perform a single test in this case. Dr. Mutra performed tests for 2 years. His tests confirmed what Syntex found and what Novex Pharma found. When the district court found his tests to be flawed because he didn't test different grades of back and different lots of KT, there's nothing in the 493 patent that requires that. And in fact, if you look at column 3, it says the ingredients used in the formulations of the present invention are typically commercially available or can be made by methods readily known to those skilled in the art. Dr. Mitra tested KT. He tested 2 other NSAIDs. He tested 3 of the preservatives, cetramide, CPC, and BAC. Lindgate testified she only ever tested BAC, and she only ever tested ketoroelectromethamine. So Dr. Mitra's tests far surpassed what anyone at Syntex ever did. And Dr. Mitra obtained his ingredients from commercial sources, including those from Novex Pharma. And I see at this point I'm out of time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Silver. Our next case is PMC Resources versus Payment Tech.